Can you take a seat? And the show will start soon. So, my name is Christine Catlama. I'm from Université Pierre et Marie Curie à Paris, en France. And I had the very great honor and the pleasure to chair this morning session on antiviral therapy with José Arribas. So you see, it's a co-chair European session. So we will have a terrific program with a lot of new data on new drugs, and we hope this you will enjoy this session. So you have the seats here. There is two microphones. Every speaker will have 12 minutes to speak, and you have 3 minutes for discussion. So the first speaker is Dr. Valdez Madruga on behalf of the Titan Group, and he will talk about the comparison 48-week efficacy data on darunavir compared to lopinavir.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here in Sydney. Today I will present data from Titan trial. It's a comparison between the two protease inhibitors, darunavir versus lopinavir, in treatment experience but lopinavir naive patients. This trial is a randomized controlled trial with 96 weeks and primary analysis at week 48. Inclusion criteria, patients need to be treatment experienced but lopinavir naive with viral load above 1,000 copies per milliliter, stable heart for 12 weeks or more, or they could be on structured treatment interruption for 4 weeks or more. A total of 785 patients were screened, and these 595 patients were randomized and treated with either darunavir 600 milligrams plus ritonavir 100 milligrams BID, or with lopinavir 400 milligrams plus ritonavir 100 milligrams BID. Both treatment arms with an OBR composed of 2 or 3 from approved NRTIs and NNRTIs. And fulvitride was disallowed in this trial. As the primary endpoint of this study was to achieve viral load below 400 copies, and the primary objective was to demonstrate no inferiority in confirmed viral load below 400 copies per milliliter with darunavir versus lopinavir at week 48. As a secondary objective was to test for superiority of darunavir over lopinavir. Other secondary objectives was to evaluate viral load below 50 copies, change in CD4 cell count, and also evaluate efficacy, safety, and tolerability over 96 weeks. Baseline characteristics. Both treatment arms were well balanced across demographic, disease characteristics, and treatment history. Patients had an average age of 41 years, mean baseline viral load 4.3 logs, and median CD4 cell count for 232 cells. A total of 22% of patients were on structured treatment interruption, and 32 were PI naive at the time of the baseline. And patients were well balanced across according to baseline resistance characteristics. In this slide, you see the proportion of patients remaining in the trial. As you can see here, for most categories, both treatment arms were well balanced. The exception was to virological failure, that more patients in the lopinavir arm presented virological failure than darunavir arm. And patients who discontinued the trial with due to adverse events were very similar between both treatment arms. The results of the trial, proportion of patients who achieved viral load below 400 COPS at week 48. As you can see here, 77% of patients in the darunavir arm achieved viral load below 400 COPS versus 67% of patients achieved viral load below 400 COPS at week 48. And this difference was statistically significant. In this graph, we see the difference between both treatment arms according to viral load below 400 COPS at week 48. As you can see here, the mean difference was 10% with confidence interval from 2 to 17. To establish non-inferiority, we need to look at the per-protocol patients population. As you can see here, the mean difference in the per-protocol population was 9% with confidence interval from 2 to 16. And this lower end of the confidence interval, 2, is above the minus 12, the cutoff for non-inferiority. Then it proves that darunavir was no inferior than lopinavir. And to establish the superiority, we need to look at the ITT population. In the ITT population, the mean difference between both treatment arms was 10% with confidence interval from 2 to 17. As this number, this lower end of the confidence interval, 2, is above the zero, the point that the two drugs were equal, it proves that darunavir was not only non-inferior, but it was superior to the lopinavir. Viral load below 50 COPS per milliliter. Again, you see that more patients in the darunavir arm, 71% of patients, versus 6% of patients achieved viral load below 50 COPS per milliliter at week 48. And this difference was again statistically significant. In this table here, we see that we analyze the subgroups according to baseline lopinavir fold change. When we exclude patients with lopinavir fold change above 40, the mean difference between both treatment arms was 10, and this difference was similar to the overall population, that was 11. This difference was highly statistically significant for non-inferiority and also significant for the superiority. Lopinavir fold change, when you take the patients with lopinavir fold change only above below 10, we see the mean difference between the both treatment arms was 7%. And this difference was, again, statistically significant for non-inferiority, but borderline significance for the superiority. The improvement in CD4 cell count were very similar between both treatment arms. The median change in CD4 cell count was 88 cells in the darunavir arm versus 81 cells in the lopinavir arm. This difference were very similar. Virological failure. Virological failure in this trial are defined that as patients who never achieved viral load below 400 COPS. And it consists of responders and non-responders. Responders are patients who achieved viral load below 400. Non-responders are patients who never achieved viral load below 400. And rebounders are patients who had achieved viral load below 400 and rebounded to viral load above 400. As you can see in this bar chart, more patients in the lopinavir arm presented virological failure than in the darunavir arm. This difference was twofold higher in the lopinavir arm. Being more conservative and excluding patients with lopinavir fold change greater than 10, we again see that more patients in the lopinavir arm presented virological failure than in the darunavir arm. As the virological failure was more frequent in the lopinavir arm, the development of primary PIs, PI mutations, and NRTI resistance-associated mutations were more frequent in the lopinavir arm than in the darunavir arm. And again, when we exclude patients with lopinavir fold change above 10, most patients in the lopinavir arm has developed primary PI mutations and NRTI RAMs than in the darunavir arm. The most common adverse events with an incidence greater than 10, you can see here that diarrhea was the most common adverse event, and it was more frequent in the lopinavir arm than in the darunavir arm. Another important adverse event was rash, and this rash was more frequent in the darunavir arm. But no grade 4 rash has occurred, and only 2 cases of rash led to discontinuation of the trial. And one of these cases was taking nevirapine in the background. The other adverse events were very similar between both treatment arms. When we look at the adverse events with grade 2 to 4, moderate to severe, possibly related to the studied medication, if an incidence above 2%, again, diarrhea was the most common adverse event, and the incidence of diarrhea was twice in the lopinavir arm than in the darunavir arm. Nausea, the second most common adverse event, was similar between both treatment arms, and rash was most common in the darunavir arm. Grade 2 to 4 laboratory abnormalities with an incidence greater than 2%, as you can see here in this table, both treatment arms presented with similar incidence of laboratory abnormalities. In conclusion, in this treatment-experienced but lopinavir-naive population, darunavir was not only non-inferior, but virologically superior to lopinavir. Darunavir was safe and well-tolerated, and darunavir provided better protection of the NRTI and the PI classes upon failure versus lopinavir. And finally, I'd like to thank the patients and their families for their participation in the trial. I'd like to thank the Titan study team, especially Eric Lefebvre and Roberta Trefiglio. And I'd like to thank the co-investigators and the investigators that are listed here. I'd like to thank my clinical team. And I'd like to thank the Tibotec for supporting this trial. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mendez, for this excellent data. So this paper is now open for discussion. Again, you have two microphones over here. And now, it's perfect. I get a number. So microphone 4, the light and the number. So the 2 and the 4.
Thank you. James Williams from the States. Thank you for the information. Just a quick question. Is it accurate to say that before 6 mutations, Persista seems to perform equally to Caledra, but after 6 mutations, Persista looks to be a good option to use after Caledra?
Yes, so we've done, as you can imagine,
Can you identify
yourself? Yes, sorry. This is Diego Morales from Tibotec, so I will answer for Jose because it's a kind of a technical question. So as you can imagine, we've done a lot of additional analysis. We have looked at patients who had a fold change of less than 10 for lopinavir, who had one primary PI mutations, and there's a statistically significant difference between darunavir and lopinavir in patients who had a lopinavir fold change less than 10 and only had one primary PI mutation. So it's not driven by six mutations. There's a difference with many less mutations than six.
Okay, microphone two. A question to Dr. Valdez?
Yeah. Yes, Keith Crawford, Howard University, Washington, D.C. Question regarding the rash. Did you screen your patients for history of sulfa allergy before enrolling them in the study?
This rash, the rashes will all kind of disease problems.
But the question is regarding sulfa allergy. The darunavir having sulfa moiety causing potential for allergic reactions. That could be a cause of the rash if they had a history of sulfa allergy.
Sabrina, who works for Tubotec, will answer this question.
Here, if I can have the microphone. So I'm Sabrina Spinoza from Tubotec. So we look at the sulfa allergy previous to start treatment, and so the rashes, there were just two cases that occurred in the darunavir arm. So we look at those data, and there was really no difference and no trend to develop more rashes if you have prior sulfa allergy.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we have to move to the next presentation. Thank you very much. So the next presentation will be given by Dr. Gulick, and it's on behalf of the ACTG group of ACTG 5211. So, Dr. Gulick, it's your turn.
Thanks, Christine. ACTG 5211 is a phase 2 study of Vicrovirok in treatment-experienced patients. I'm pleased to present today the 48-week results on behalf of the ACTG 5211 protocol team. Our study objective was to evaluate the safety, tolerability, and antiretroviral activity of a Vicrovirok-containing regimen. We enrolled patients who were ART-experienced, who were failing their current regimen as evidenced by a viral load level of at least 5,000 copies per mil on a ritonavir-containing regimen. All patients had a documented R5 phenotype using the Trofil assay, and we stratified at enrollment by both envafolimab use and a baseline CD4 cell count less than or at least 50 cells per microliter. This slide shows the study design. So patients entered screening while taking their failing ART regimen. During screening, they underwent genotypic and phenotypic resistance testing as well as tropism testing. At study entry, they were randomized to one of four study arms. They added to their failing regimen either placebo or Vicrovirok at one of three doses, 5, 10, or 15 milligrams once daily. They continued that regimen through day 14, and then at day 14, based on the results of resistance testing and the treatment history, optimized their background regimen. Because of the timing of this study, there was not darunavir or tipranavir available for the optimized background regimen. At that point, they continued their randomized therapy plus the optimized regimen through 48 weeks of the study. Access to Vicrovirok was provided in a separate rollover study for any patient who completed ACTG 5211. All regimens contained ritonavir, both the failing regimen and the optimized regimen. We defined virologic failure as a confirmed less than one log decrease in viral load level from baseline after at least 16 weeks of the study. We also included a crossover option to people who experienced virologic failure that they could receive Vicrovirok or could increase the dose of Vicrovirok. We enrolled 118 subjects with a median age of 46, represented 92% men and 8% women. One-third non-whites and two-thirds whites were enrolled. One-third were envafolimab experienced. The median viral load level on the study was about 36,000 copies per mil at baseline, and the CD4 cell count, 146 cells per microliter. As required by the protocol, 100% of patients had R5 virus at screening. In terms of disposition through the 48 weeks of the study, study treatment was discontinued early by 82% of the placebo arm, 30% of the 10 milligram arm, and 37% of the 15 milligram arm. I neglected to say that the study monitoring committee, an independent group, closed the 5 milligram arm early because of suggestion of inferior virologic activity in that arm. Most of the results I will present will focus on the other three treatment arms. In terms of virologic failure through 48 weeks, 86% on the placebo arm experienced virologic failure, compared with 27% on the 10 milligram arm and 33% on the 15 milligram arm. This slide shows the primary efficacy endpoint on the study, which is the median change in HIV RNA from baseline, and this is using an intent to treat analysis. As you can see, both the 10 milligram arm shown in green and the 15 milligram arm shown in light blue produced a potent decrease in viral load level on the order of about 2 logs, which was durable through the end of 48 weeks. At the end of 48 weeks, the 15 milligram arm was 1.4 logs below baseline and the 10 milligram arm 1.9 logs below baseline level. This slide shows the proportion in each of 3 treatment groups who achieved a viral load level less than 50 copies per mil over the course of the study. Once again, you can see that the 2 Bikrovirok arms produced more patients reduced to less than 50 copies. At the end of 48 weeks, approximately 30 to 40% of patients in the Bikrovirok groups are suppressed below 50, and that compares with only 10% in the placebo group. CD4 cell counts increased notably in both Bikrovirok groups, and you can see by the end of 48 weeks, about 100 to 130 median rise above baseline for the Bikrovirok patients. We looked at a subgroup analysis based on virologic response in the 2 Bikrovirok groups, 10 and 15 milligrams, by enfuvirtide use. And I'd like to remind you that enfuvirtide use was not randomized on this study. It was chosen by patients and their providers. The largest decrease in viral load level, shown for you here with a mean decrease over 2 logs, the bar represents the median increase, and the 25th and 75th quartiles, the whiskers represent the range of responses. But what you can see is that the 12 patients who took Bikrovirok were enfuvirtide naive and added enfuvirtide as part of their background regimen had the greatest virologic response, again, over 2 log mean decrease. That's similar to the 29 patients who took Bikrovirok but never used enfuvirtide either prior to the study or as part of their background regimen. You can see about a 1.5 log mean decrease. The least response was seen in the 19 patients who took Bikrovirok but had had enfuvirtide experience, and you can see about just under a log response in that group. Again, caution interpreting these are not randomized groups. In terms of tropism, again, per protocol, 100% of patients entered the study with R5 virus. However, at the time of study entry, which was prior to receiving study drug, 86% continued with R5 virus, 10% had changed their tropism to a dual or mixed phenotype, and an additional 4 patients had a missing result. On study treatment, of the 106 patients at study entry with either R5 or missing tropism results, a total of 18 subjects changed tropism over the course of the study, 3 on the placebo arm, 2 following crossover to the Bikrovirok following virologic failure, and 15 on the 3 Bikrovirok arms, 8 in the 5 milligram arm, 4 in the 10 milligram, and 3 in the 15 milligram arm. Of 26 subjects with R5 virus at study entry on Bikrovirok who experienced virologic failure, 9, or 35%, had dual-mixed or X4 virus. We undertook several post hoc evaluations to try to relate tropism with virologic response. Here's one look at that. This graph shows the time to virologic failure in patients at study entry, 10 who had dual or mixed virus, shown in yellow, and compared that with the 80 who continued to have R5 virus documented by the tropism assay. Recall that our definition of virologic failure could not occur before 16 weeks of study. There is a shorter time to failure in the dual mixed group compared with the R5 group. However, note that the numbers are small and this does not reach statistical significance. We were also interested in what occurs after tropism change in people receiving Vicrobirok in terms of viral load levels and CD4 responses. What we've done here is to look at the 23 patients who had a tropism change, set the change at the time point zero, and then described what happened to viral load levels and CD4 cell counts over time. Note that there's a different length of follow-up because tropism changes occurred at different time points during the study for the 23 patients. But I think what you can see, viral load level in yellow really doesn't change after tropism change, and CD4 cell count remains relatively stable for up to 48 weeks after tropism change, although again, I would caution that the numbers are smaller on the right-hand side of the figure. In terms of adverse events, there was no significant difference for grade 3 or 4 adverse events, including signs, symptoms, and laboratory abnormalities among the 4 study arms. No seizures were reported over the 48 weeks of the study. Malignancies, we have reported that 8 subjects randomized to Vicrovirok, either through the 48 weeks of this study or in a conservative approach, we also include any malignancy which occurred on the rollover study. We've previously reported 6 of these at week 24, and that included 2 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, 2 Hodgkin's lymphoma, 1 gastric adenocarcinoma, and a squamous cell carcinoma. An additional 2 malignancies occurred since that time, a basal cell carcinoma in the 10 milligram group, and a recurrence of Kaposi sarcoma in a patient randomized to 5 milligrams. In addition, 2 subjects randomized to placebo developed squamous cell carcinoma. We previously reported both of these patients. One of the 2 patients briefly received Vicrobirok at a dose of 10 milligrams. In conclusion, ACTG-5211 shows that in treatment-experienced patients, following optimization of the background antiretroviral therapy regimen, that Vicrobirok at a dose of either 10 or 15 milligrams when combined with ritonavir demonstrated sustained durable antiretroviral activity over 48 weeks. We also showed that co-receptor change was documented in about a third of patients who were taking Vicrobirok at the time of virologic failure. Vicrobirok was generally well tolerated on this study. The relationship of Vicrobirok to malignancy remains uncertain, really because of the small sample size of this study. Longer-term follow-up of these patients will continue through a total of 5 years. I'd like to acknowledge the members of the ACTG-5211 protocol team, my co-chairs Dan Karitzkis and Charlie Flexner, our statisticians at the Harvard School of Public Health, and our DAIDS medical officer, Katie Godfrey. In addition, team investigators listed here, many of whom are in the audience, and other important members of the ACTG-5211 protocol team. Also like to acknowledge the pharmaceutical supporter, Sharing Plough Research Institute, Wayne Greaves and Lisa Dunkel being part of the team, and Owen Coakley from Monogram Biosciences, and the study sponsor, the Division of AIDS through the AIDS Clinical Trial Group, NIAID at NIH. Lastly, the 25 ACTG study sites who contributed patients to the study and followed them. And finally, and very importantly, the study participants themselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very clear presentation. So now it's open for discussion. Microphone 2.
Frank Rehm from Minneapolis, USA. I'm interested in the comparison of the plasma levels in your study and the naive trial. Recall that in the naive trial, the drug didn't perform quite as well and was unboosted. Dosing was 5 times the dose, however. And I'm just wondering what the plasma levels are boosted compared to unboosted.
So the question was, Frank noted that the doses that we used on 5211 were lower than what was used in the naive study that used Vicrovirok, which was sponsored by Schering. In our study, we required all patients to be on ritonavir. That enhances the plasma levels of Vicrovirok, and the doses in this study were actually chosen to mirror the concentrations achieved with unboosted Vicrovirok as used in the Schering study. The other comment you made was about the viral load level at baseline. I'll just remind you that this is a study of treatment-experienced patients who were failing their current regimen. The baseline viral load at the time of study entry here was about 36,000 copies. That's certainly less than it would be on a treatment-naive study.
Cristina Mussini, Italy. When you show the data concerning the slope in viral load and CD4 count after the shift in the tropism, did they change treatment since they were on treatment failure, or were they kept on the Decrivera?
Thanks for bringing up that point. It's actually a mixture of approaches in that study group. Early on in the protocol, we required that patients discontinue the study drug Vicrovirok following a tropism shift. But with increasing information, we amended the protocol to allow the patient and their provider to assess whether they were continuing to have a virologic and immunologic response. And thus, most of the patients were able to continue Vicrovirok. The slide I showed was actually a mixture. It's an intent to treat, so many different strategies were employed. Some patients ended up discontinuing Vicrovirok. Others continued it for the full course.
Bolin, Los Angeles. Can you further characterize that? I think it was 14% of folks who switched their tropism before they actually started taking drug. What was their treatment before they did that? I mean, were they on treatment or were they off treatment or what?
So again, all patients were required to be on a ritonavir-containing regimen at the time of screening for the study, and they had to have R5 virus at screening. We did another tropism assay at the time of study entry that was prior to any patient receiving the study drug, and the number was 10% of the population switched their tropism from R5 to a dual or mixed phenotype.
Could you explain that slide, Chip, that said, I think, viral failure based on baseline tropism?
Right. So we're looking at the same population I just mentioned. So everyone had R5 at baseline, but 10% of the people had switched their tropism at the time of study entry, again, prior to receiving Vicrovirok. We were interested in how those two groups, those two subsets, and again, I would caution people, this was a post hoc analysis, but we were interested in what their time to virologic failure would be. So in the yellow line were the 10 patients who had dual or mixed phenotype at the time of study entry, and the remainder were the 80 patients who had R5 phenotype. All 90 of those patients received Vicrovirok. What we showed was that the time to virologic failure was faster in people who had dual or mixed virus, but because of small numbers over the time, it didn't reach statistical significance.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. So, after the PI, DCCR5, we are moving now to the integrase inhibitors, and we are pleased to welcome Dr. Murray from Sydney and on behalf of mixed Australian-American team to talk about the viral decay of Valtegravir.
Thank you. So Valtegravir belongs to the new class of HIV integrase inhibitors. It prevents incorporation of the completed HIV DNA genome into the host cell genome. It acts after reverse transcription and so targets a novel process of the HIV-1 life cycle. There's also a different process to protease inhibitors that reduce infectious virus from previously infected cells. So there are some results in phase 2 studies for individuals with multiple class drug resistance. Patients on the Valtegravir arm, combined with optimized background therapy, suppress virus faster than those without Valtegravir. So these are in individuals with multiple class resistance, so it should be expected that perhaps Valtegravir, belonging to a new class of drugs, may prove superior in that instance. But in the cases of individuals that are antiretroviral naive, we may not expect such an improvement, And we wouldn't expect difference in viral decay dynamics for antiretroviral naive patients under raltegravir. Typically, after antiretroviral therapy, HIV RNA in peripheral blood experiences multiphasic decay. The first phase, with half-life about 1.5 days, tracks the loss of productively infected cells, as these are lost and not replaced due to prevention of infection. After about a week, there's a slower second phase decay with a half-life of about 14 days, and this is believed to track the production of virus from long-lived infected cells. Afterwards, under around about the 50-copy assay, there's a third phase where the origins of this are unclear. So, protocol 004, part one of that, looked at 10 days of monotherapy with raltegravir in antiretroviral naive patients. So this was looking at dosing and effects of raltegravir. There are four doses, 100, 200, 400, and 600 milligrams versus placebo. These are plots of individual patients over that 10 days. So there was no difference in the... They all experienced monophasic decay with a median 2.2 log decrease and with no significant difference between the four dosage groups. So all groups were similar with a 1.2 day half-life over all raltegravir patients. Part two of this study looked at combination therapy of raltegravir with tenofovir and lamivudine versus another arm with efavirenz and those same two drugs. Once again, with the four dosage groups, approximately 40 in each group, as well as in the efavirenz group. Patients still treatment naive. So they follow these patients over 48 weeks of therapy. So each of the raltegravir groups achieved undetectable HIV RNA at the 50-copy assay limit, but faster than the efavirenz group. So at day 15, so the first time point after the start of therapy, at least 30% of individuals in the raltegravir groups were below the 50-copy limit, whereas only 11% for those individuals on the efavirenz arm. Comparisons of each of the raltegravir groups against the efavirenz arm were significantly different, so with a p-value of 0.047. At day 29, the difference was even more discernible, with at least 55% of individuals in the raltegravir dosage groups being below the 50-copy assay, with less than a quarter for the efavirenz arm, with a p-value for each of the comparisons of raltegravir against efavirenz of at most 0.003. By days 85 and 112, some of the raltegravir groups were similar to the efavirenz arm. By day 168, there was no difference between the raltegravir and efavirenz. So we combined all patients in the raltegravir groups, and we see the fast initial decrease in their viral load. So these are looking at medians, interquartile ranges, and confidence intervals for these, and so we comparison of the raltegravir versus the efavirenz shows the decrease in the second phase virus compared to the efavirenz arm. We can compare these results to results already published about antiretroviral regimens against treatment-naive individuals. So these are results from Karitska's looking at first and second phase viral decay for individuals on a three-drug efavirenz arm, a four-drug efavirenz arm, and a triple NRTI regimen, producing similar dynamics. The three-drug efavirenz arm from this protocol was consistent with those results. The raltegravir arm was significantly lower than this in the second phase viral levels. So under raltegravir, second phase viral levels were 70% lower than for the efavirenz arm, and this was highly significant. On the other hand, there was no significant difference between the slopes of viral decay in the second phase. However, these data means that the theories about second phase viral loads are inconsistent with this. So if Ultegravir acts solely as an integrase inhibitor, then it should not affect viral production from cells that have HOV already integrated into the DNA. So we should not see, therefore, any difference between the Ultegravir and efavirenz arms if second phase virus was produced from long-lived infected cells. Similarly, some of the other theories for second phase virus production are inconsistent, including dissociation of virus from follicular dendritic cells and downregulation of cytotoxic lymphocyte response. There are some other theories that we were interested in investigating, however. So to investigate these, we constructed some mathematical models. We constructed three models. This first one is a variation of the original theory that virus comes from long-lived infected cells. However, so instead of virus being produced directly from those cells, we had that it provided new rounds of productive infection where virus then came from the new productively infected cells. We still needed the incorporation of long-lived infected cells in this to provide the slow dynamic we see in second phase viral levels. Here we hypothesised that Ultegravir was more effective at inhibiting these new rounds of productive infection. The second model assumed that there was a pool of lately infected cells with HOV DNA that was completely reverse transcribed but unintegrated, and that the second phase viral level virus arose from productively infected cells that were converted from this latent form to an integrated form, and they produced the virus seen at second phase viral levels. And in this case, Ultegravir inhibited the incorporation of the completed HOV DNA genome that was unintegrated into the integrated part for the productively infected cells. The third model assumed that Ultegravir penetrated a sanctuary site better than other drugs and therefore limited the output of virus from the source. So we compared simulations of each of these models against data from the monotherapy part of the trial. So that provided the first phase data. From the combination therapy part for Ultegravir and the combination therapy part for the efavirenz arms. So the Ultegravir simulations are solid lines, whereas the efavirenz arm is represented by the dashed lines. So the first two models were consistent with the data, whereas the third model did not reproduce the data as well. So model one assumes that second phase virus originates from productively infected cells that have been infected from long-lived infected cells, and that Ultegravir inhibits this new round of infection more effectively than other drugs. The second model assumes that second phase virus originates from activation of lately infected cells that convert to productively infected cells with integrated virus. In this case, Ultegravir inhibits integration, which is a process that would not be affected by the reverse transcriptase inhibitors or protease inhibitors. So in conclusion, we find that Ultegravir is a potent antiretroviral drug from the new class of HIV integrase inhibitors. It reduces second phase viral levels by 70% more than current regimens. The data is inconsistent with theories that second phase virus originates from long-lived infected cells. On the other hand, it does have the possibility of being through a new infection from long-lived infected cells or from activation of latently infected cells with unintegrated HIV DNA. In either case, Ultegravir is a very potent new drug. Thank you.
Thank you for this excellent, very precise communication. Discussion?
Jan van Munsen from Hamburg, Germany. Did you have a chance to look at proviral DNA decay?
And no, that wasn't available, I'm afraid.
And the same was said, and the chance to look at the LTR, two LTR circles?
No. No.
Okay.
So, maybe I try a technical question. Apart from thinking about the pathogenesis, what will you think make a big difference of these difference? What about the penetration in the other reservoir? Do you have any idea of these different penetration or different action is also true in CSF, in CMEM?
We don't have any data on that, but the modeling of that aspect of penetration into different sanctuary sites was not as good at reproducing the data. So.
Okay, so it's mostly for plasma.
Yes.
Cells. Good. So if no more questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next presentation will be another raltegravir study. It's entitled Rapid Onset and Durable Antiretroviral Effect of Raltegravir, a novel HIV-1 integrase inhibitor as part of combination ART in treatment HIV-infected patients. These are 48-week data and will be presented by Dr. Markovits.
Thank you, and I'm proud to present these data on behalf of the Protocol 004 team and my colleagues at Merck. This is a truly international study done in 7 countries on multiple continents, as well as designed and conducted with our team at Merck Research Laboratories. You've heard a lot of this morning, but I guess I'll go over it again. Raltegravir is an HIV integrase inhibitor. It's a novel drug. It has potent in vitro activity. It is metabolized primarily via glucuronidation. It is not a CYP3A4 substrate, therefore it does not require ritonavir boosting for dosing. In phase 1 studies, it was studied up to doses of 800 milligrams and was found appropriate for BID dosing. And at the 100 milligram dose, had a trough level that was in excess of the predicted IC95. And because of its metabolism, no dose adjustments were necessary when used with conventional ARTs. You've heard about Protocol 004. It's a 2-part study, with part 1 being monotherapy in naive patients, followed by part 2, where combination therapy was used. And as you heard and has been published, HIV RNA decreases of 1.7 to 2.2 log were seen across the MK518 study arms, and there were no differences between study arms, so all doses were taken into this part 2 of the study. And this is part 2 study design. Patients who participated in part 1 received the same dose. Patients who received placebo received efavirenz. Approximately 150 additional patients were randomized into part 2, and key inclusion criteria included susceptibility to efavirenz, 3-TC, and tenofovir, no prior antiretroviral therapy, viral loads above 5,000 copies. There was stratification for RNA levels above and below 50,000, and CD4 counts needed to be above 100 cells per millimeter cubed. Endpoints included viral load, CD4 cell counts, and assessments of adverse experiences. The hypotheses were that raltegravir in combination with tenofovir and lamivudine would be safe and well-tolerated and have comparable antiretroviral activity to efavirenz with the same NUC backbone. The patient characteristics were the same across groups, as you can see on this slide, about 37 years or so, a predominantly male, a large percentage of non-whites. Viral loads were approximately 4.8 logs, rather healthy CD4 cell counts, and approximately a third of the patients across the arms had AIDS at previous AIDS diagnoses at baseline. This is the disposition of all randomized patients. As you can see, the number of patients who discontinued therapy across arms was relatively small and balance for the efavirenz arms and the raltegravir arms. Remember, there are 4 raltegravir arms and 1 efavirenz arm. 2 patients discontinued for lack of efficacy. A total of 7 patients withdrew consent, and there were some discontinuations for a variety of other reasons. The primary endpoint was the percent of patients with viral loads below 400 copies per ml at 24 weeks. and this is the non-complete or equal failure data. I presented the 24-week data approximately a year ago in Toronto, and you can see that at 24 weeks, nearly 90 to 100% of the patients were below that level of detection. And the good news is that that antiviral level is sustained during the subsequent 24 weeks. So when we get out to 48 weeks, approximately 90% or so of the patients in the efavirenz arm and the raltegravir arms are below the level of detection. This is the less than 50 copy non-complete or equal failure analysis. You've heard a very elegant analysis from John about the rapidity with which the patients on raltegravir become quote-unquote undetectable or below 50, so I won't belabor that point. But at 24 weeks, you can see approximately 85 to 95% of the patients are below 50 copies at 24 weeks, and this effect is maintained at 48 weeks with approximately 83 to 88% of the patients having viral loads below detection. That's the 50-copy assay. Looking at the change from baseline in HIV RNA observed failure analysis, you can see that very potent drop in viral load in all study arms, and this antiviral activity is maintained across the 48 weeks in all raltegravir arms as well as the efavirenz containing arm. Concomitant with the viral load responses, CD4 cell count increases were robust in all arms and were between approximately 125 and 200 plus cells per study arm on average. Let me now discuss the virologic failures because I know there's a lot of interest in resistance to integrase inhibitors. In this study, virologic failure was defined as either non-response, which was defined as greater than 400 copies at week 24 or early discontinuation, or a virologic relapse, where in patients who went below 400 copies on their initial response, they went to above 400 copies or a one log increase above the nadir level. With these definitions, five of the patients met the criteria for virologic favor in the raltegravir group and one in the efavirenz group. Please note that patients with virologic failure were allowed to continue in the study. Therefore, when I told you earlier, there were only two discontinuations due to lack of efficacy, so that's why there's a difference in number. This is the genotypic analysis of patients with virologic failure. Let me first emphasize the patients on raltegravir. In the 100 milligram arm, there was a patient with no response, and this patient had multiple mutations within the integrase, the signature N155H, along with three other integrase inhibitor mutations. This patient also had changes in RT consistent with exposure to his other drugs. Please note that in another patient with relapse, there were no integrase inhibitor mutations seen, and relapse was associated with typical signature mutations to 3TC resistance. In the patients in the 200 milligram raltegravir arm, and that's N equal 3, one of the three had the signature N155H alone. Two of the patients had no changes in the integrase gene, whereas two of these patients had the signature M184V or M184I. The one patient who relapsed in the efavirenz arm had a change in integrase that is considered a polymorphism, but had the signature G190E to efavirenz resistance and a K65R. Adverse events were quite common across study arms, and approximately 80 to 90% had any clinical adverse event, but please note that the number of serious adverse events were extremely rare and balanced along study arms. Of note, drug-related adverse events as defined by the following statement. Investigators determined the adverse event to be possibly, probably, or definitely caused by study drug regimen. It was about 50% in the raltegravir arms, about 70% in the efavirenz-containing arm. Any laboratory adverse event was, again, relatively rare, about 25%. Only one patient discontinued therapy due to a laboratory adverse event. And again, laboratory abnormalities related to drug were extremely rare. These are the common drug-related adverse events seen over the 48-week period. and they're relatively well-balanced among the raltegravir group. There was not a dose response seen as far as adverse events between raltegravir groups. And if you go down the line, I think one would predict quite naturally that the most common adverse events that were seen in the efavirenz arm were CNS-related, and these were relatively rare in the raltegravir containing arms. Of note, ALT increase was seen in the raltegravir containing arm, and this was balanced in the efavirenz group as well. Serum lipids were measured during the course of the 48-week study. Total cholesterol increased by approximately 20% in the efavirenz arm and dropped 2.3% in the raltegravir arm, and this is statistically significant. LDL levels were dropped in the raltegravir arm and by 7% and increased approximately 3% in the efavirenz arm. Again, this difference does reach statistical significance. And triglycerides did go up significantly in the efavirenz arm. Again, a statistically significant difference. So the safety summary for this study. Overall, the adverse event profiles were generally similar across treatment groups. There were no dose-related toxicities. Drug-related adverse events were less common with raltegravir, 48%, than efavirenz, 71%, and there were no drug-related adverse events. Neuropsychiatric symptoms were less common with raltegravir than efavirenz, 8% versus 21% at week 8, 13% versus 29% at week 48. Grade 3 and 4 laboratory abnormalities were uncommon, and raltegravir had a neutral effect on serum lipids. In conclusion, raltegravir is a promising new integrase inhibitor with rapid and durable antiretroviral effect. In treatment-naive patients with viral loads less than 5,000 copies and CD4 cell counts above 100, raltegravir was active at all doses studied. It had potent activity. 83 to 88% of the patients were undetectable using the 50-copy assay, and the drug was generally well-tolerated. Thank you for your attention.
The presentation is now open for questions from the audience.
It's a little bit challenging.
No questions. I will ask you, have you mentioned this? Did these patients have baseline genotypes before they entered?
Yes. Yes. So those, the genotypes I showed were all treatment emergent.
Another question, Martin. So since efavirenz is once daily and raltegravir BID, and if I remember correctly, the study was not blinded. So what do you think could be the problem of compliance with those naive patients? I mean, could it play a role in those who are not fully suppressed?
Did you say the study was not blinded or was blinded? I'm sorry. It was a blinded study.
It was completely
blinded. Yes. The patients basically had multiple bottles, so they did not know what their assignment was, number one. So they were dosing twice daily. Adherence actually was measured in the study, and the patients who did, and they had diaries. And as you know, that is the most imperfect way to measure adherence. In the patients that did have virologic failure, there were intermittent missed doses. But one of our patients, for example, who had wild type at breakthrough, had perfect diaries and then finally admitted to not taking drug for 2 weeks after 3 months of, grueling.
So, and you have concentration, though.
Pardon me?
Concentration, drug concentration, plasma.
That's not available.
So there is a question.
It's measured, but not available.
Question from microphone 2.
Tony Vergara, Brazil. What's the clinical implication of the faster viral load decay?
So. I think this was a better question for John, but I'll try to answer it what I think. I think what it looks like at this point, that it's a combination of factors, including sort of understanding that there's a mechanism whereby latently infected cells with unintegrated virus, then go on to integrate and then make virus, and that's a contribution to the end of the first phase and the beginning of the second phase, and that's of interest from a pathogenesis point of view and how that plays into dissemination of virus. I don't think we know the answer. It does not look like that the drug gets into a sequestered site better than another drug, per se. But I think that's, again, the study was not designed necessarily to do very intensive viral dynamics, and I think it would probably be better to do something, some of the studies like we've done, where you hospitalize patients and get viral loads very, very, very frequently to really try to tease out exactly what's going on mechanistically. At this point, I think it's far too early to say whether or not there's going to be a clinical benefit, per se, of having raltegravir in a regimen compared to efavirenz. The 48-week data would support that the antiviral activity of both drugs is equivalent.
So any idea why not even HDL increase?
No.
A very final question. I mean, you take the response rate was defined as less than 400 at 6 months. Some of our guidelines, including ours in France, is now more stringent for naive patients and take less than 50 at 6 months. If you were going to take this analysis, did you see something rising between 50 and 400? We learned from you that everybody should be less than 50, so we have to...
Well, I think you remember this is a small study.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's only 40 patients in the efavirenz arm, and you're pooling raltegravir at multiple doses. The dose that has been selected for moving forward in both phase 3 and filing for approval is 400 milligrams. The next step is to study raltegravir in naive patients with a very stringent endpoint. Thank you.
Thank you. So now we move to a new NNRTI. The presentation is entitled The Metabolic Profile of TMC278, an Investigational Non-Nucleoside Reverse Transcriptase Inhibitor, and will be presented by Dr. Rux Rumfam.
Thank you very much. I'm great honored to present to you the result on behalf of multinational colleagues and coordinators. So the result is regarding the metabolic profile of TMC278 and new generation NNRTI. As you have heard both at CROIS and also this morning with a very nice presentation at the plenary session by Dr. Enron about this compound. So the TMC278 is a next generation NNRTI, has been shown in vitro activity against Y-type and NNRTI-resistant isolates. And the phase 2B, which is named as a TMC278-C204 trial at 48-week results, efficacy results, and the safety profile has been shown that the potent and sustained efficacy of this compound as a once-daily in a naive population. Efavirenz, as all we familiar with, is commonly associated with metabolic abnormalities, particularly increases in cholesterol and triglycerides levels. Again, just to remind us again about the study design. So this is the design of the C24 study. Basically, the total sample size of 368 individuals had been randomized into four arms. The efavirenz arm as an open label, and the dose finding arm of a TMC278 as a blinded with 25 milligrams, 75 milligrams, and 155 milligram once daily, all also combined with the selected two nodes, and stratified by the backbone of the NRTI. As you can see here, about 75% of this study population received ACT-3DC, and 25 received, say, tenofovir, FTC, And again, this is a multinational study from Asia, Africa, US, Europe, Russia, and Latin America. And so the objective is to assess the metabolic profile of this compound comparison with efavirenz in this trial of C204. And this is the parameters of changes from baseline has been analyzed. So the total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, high density lipoprotein, HDL cholesterol, triglyceride, glucose, and the assessment of the insulin resistance. And the samples were taken at screening baseline and various time point up until 48 weeks. So here's the demographics baseline characteristics. And you can see that one-third of the patients were females, and overall they are comparable, both the median age, while load about 75,000 copy per mil, and the CD4 approximately with the median of 200 cells. And this is the baseline metabolic profiles. As you can see here, again, it's very comparable. Look at the total cholesterol between the combined the TMC278 and the efavirenz arm, LDL cholesterol, HDL, and the ratio. The only higher ratio here, value here, is a triglyceride. However, there's a high variation if you look at the standard deviation of this TMC278 arm. And this is the result of the mean changes from baseline of the metabolic profile I had mentioned at 48 weeks. The unit here is measured as a milligram per deciliter. At highlights in yellow here, you can see that the total cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol, and HDL cholesterol in the combined TMC278 arm has significantly lower than the efavirenz arm. And you can see that the p-value is below 0.001. And the triglyceride arm, the 278 combined group also have a lower mean changes compared to the efavirenz arm with a p-value of below 0.05. Next slide. I'm sorry. Yeah, and to look at the plot here, and this is in gray, represent the result, the mean changes of total cholesterol from efavirenz compared to the three arms of different doses of TMC275. You can see that it's significantly different with a higher p-value of below 0.001. A similar differences can be seen with a different magnitude again. In gray, the efavirenz and different color, blue, red, and green, from different doses of TMC278. Again, it's very significant difference. Similar finding with the HDL cholesterol level. However, when we look at the ratio of total cholesterol versus HDL cholesterol ratio, there's no significant difference in the decline from the baseline of all groups. Regarding the main changes in triglyceride over time, there's a small increase from baseline in triglyceride from efavirenz group, but not from the three arms of the TMC 278 dose groups with a p-value of 0.05. In conclusion, TMC 278 or efavirenz resulted in minimal changes in lipid profile at week 48 and may have a potential benefit versus efavirenz. No TMC 278 dose relationship in metabolic profiles. And mean changes from baseline in glucose level and insulin sensitivity were minimal and not clinically relevant for both groups. There are two parallel phase 3s for the 96-week trial are planned and will be started by the end of this year. To end my talk, finally I'd like to acknowledge all the patients participating in this study, including the family for the support, all the study teams, DSMB member, Tibotec's coordinating staff, and all the PIs from various countries, as you can see, and from many sites in each country. Thank you very much for your attention.
So any questions from the audience? Microphone 4.
Yeah, you guys plan to do any DEXA scanning to measure body composition changes in both arms?
I think that's a very good question. We start our discussion after we've seen the data of effluence in terms of the, you know. So I think that's a good suggestion. Yes, thank you.
How about any baseline differences in the amount of patients taking thiamine analogs in efavirenz versus
2-7-8? There's a balance between the two arms in terms of NOOC, because 70% of all the participants taking ACT-2-ATC. Yes.
Yeah, but no, you did not do a baseline distribution.
Okay. Yeah, we haven't looked at that carefully.
So microphone 2.
Just to respond to that question.
Yes, please.
That was a stratification factor, the backbone.
I'm sorry about it. Yeah.
Combivir and Truvada was stratified.
Yes. So the backbone had been stratified up front at the beginning. Okay. And the two, I'm sorry, please. Andrew?
Andrew Carr, Sydney. It's a little surprising to see the various lipid fractions change less. And one reason that might be, apart from the drugs, is that the weight changes were different between the groups. Were they the same or were they different?
Do you mean the different or what? Could you repeat
changes in, just changes in weight, in kilograms from weight. Baseline. Were they the same in all the arms?
I'm sorry, we don't have that data at the moment. Yeah, that's a good suggestion to look at that. Yeah.
Microphone 2.
Yeah, hi, Kathy Anastas, New York City. I'm wondering if you have adequate power to do sub-analyses by ancestry or sex, since both HDL and triglyceride really vary substantially with women and people of color having better, more favorable profiles. In addition, having a higher increase in HDL is, of course, a favorable response. So it makes it somewhat hard to determine which one actually does better in this case, which drug is actually doing better. Can you comment?
I think we haven't looked at that subgroup analysis, but I think look at the gender, because this is a univariate analysis. We have been. Maybe Katia, could you have anything to add?
I just wanted to add to the previous question about weight, and we did look at weight changes and disbalances, but there weren't any. And also for the women, there was an equal proportion of women in the efavirenz group versus the 2-7-8 groups. Of course, the ratio suggestion, total cholesterol and versus HDL is appropriate.
So I have one final question. For patients who received 2-7-8, the changes in lipids were the same if they receive ACT or if they received tenofovir?
I don't think I have that answer. Actually, they stratify, but I haven't looked at that sub-analysis. Yes.
Okay, thank you. So now the last presentation is about a new CCR5 inhibitor. It's entitled Potent Antiretroviral Activity of the Once Daily CCR5 Antagonist INCB, followed by many numbers, over 14 days of monotherapy. It will be presented by Dr. Cohen.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the conference organizers, and it's not so hard. 9471 is what we'll call it. And so this is the first data being presented of this once-daily CCR5 inhibitor, 9471, given for 14 days of monotherapy. Some background on 9471 is that it is a selective CCR5 inhibitor with a 90% IC50 for the drug in vitro of 8 to 10 nanomolar. And when we do the correction for protein binding, the protein binding adjusted IC90, as you can see, is 50 to 60 nanomolar. And so you'll look for that target in terms of our dosing. It's also additive or synergistic with other antivirals. Phase 1 studies were done and illustrated for us that there was rapid absorption and a prolonged plasma half-life of approximately 60 hours. There's also a low peak-to-trough ratio. And based on some of the data that were done previous to this study, the C-trough with 200 milligrams was predicted to achieve a concentration of 400 nanomolar, and that was the dose that went into this phase 1 study. Here are the baseline characteristics of the population of 23 people who participated. These were all HIV-positive adults who were either treatment-naive or treatment-experienced. If they were treatment-experienced, they had no recent antiviral treatment for at least the past 3 months. They had a screening viral load of at least 4 log, and there was a 14-day dosing period with some follow-up visits, as I'll show you. Mean baseline viral load, as you can see, of the population who entered was approximately 40 to 50,000 copies. The CD4 count at entry was over 500, as you can also see for the group. And as you can see, there were equal numbers of people who were either treatment naive or treatment experienced who were assigned to either the placebo or the 200 milligram dose. Here are the demographics of those who enrolled. As I mentioned, 23 people enrolled and all 23 completed this study. Their age and their race as listed here, as well as their gender. The endpoints for this trial, as you'd expect for a phase 1 study, were the mean and median change in viral load as well as adverse events. We also have some secondary ways that the viral load data were analyzed, including thresholds of the percent who achieved various thresholds as listed here on the slide, as well as the percent below certain thresholds, below 450. Here are the pharmacokinetics, and as you can see here, their HIV-negative subjects are plotted as well as those of the HIV-positive subjects in this study. You can see that there's similar PK between our HIV-negative patient populations and HIV-positive patients, as you can see here in the table. The Cmax, the C-trough, and the AUC are quite similar. I'll also point out that we did achieve a C-trough of about 440 nanomolar. And this, again, I'll remind you, is about six-fold higher than what was the target for the concentration in the HIV-positive subjects of 394. Again, with our target of about 60, we were at least six-fold greater than the target that we were looking to achieve. So here are the main results of the study, the antiviral activity. As you can see here, the drug was given for 14 days, and at day 14, there was a 1.7 log decline. 2 days later, at day 16, we achieved the nadir decline of 1.8 log. You'll notice that almost 1 week later, at day 20, we're still 1.7 log below baseline. Indeed, at day 28, 2 weeks after the last dose was administered, we're still 0.8 log below baseline. You can see here, of course, that the placebo having no response at all. Shown here are the data when now broken down by patients who were either treatment naive or previous treatment experienced. No prior CCR5 experience was allowed, so this experience would include other classes, and as expected, there's no bearing of the impact of previous treatment on the activity of the drug, and they're essentially superimposable, whether they were treatment naive or the 9 patients who were treatment experienced. The tropism findings for this study. So tropism was determined at screening, and then again at baseline pre-dose, again at day 7 or day 14, and then at day 28 after dosing was discontinued for 2 weeks, and then at follow-up. There were 2 patients of the 19 who were on drug and who did show a tropism change. Both of these patients had a history of treatment experienced. Patient number 1 was R5 at screening, as required, and also at day minus 1, the day that dosing was started, but then had a dual mixed population at day 7 and again at day 28. And on some clonal sequencing data that have been done, there is evidence of a dual mixed virus population that was detectable at day minus 1 at very low levels. Patient number 2 also entered with R5 screening, and again as well as at day minus 1. This patient also had dual mixed populations that arose at day 14,
but then the population reverted to an R5 population at day 28. Once again, clonal sequencing would suggest that this dual mixed population arose from an unidentified ancestral virus, meaning that it could not be detected, but was also different enough from the population of viruses at baseline to suggest that this was not a progression of resistance, but simply an unidentified ancestral virus that must have been mixed in the population at a very low level. Both patients, however, did revert to an R5 population after the day 28 visit in some additional follow-ups, and I'll point out that these data are quite similar to other CCR5 antagonist studies that were presented as monotherapy. So in reviewing then the antiviral response at NADER, including now the distinction of those two patients who did have the dual mixed population as well, you can see here now breaking down the data by various thresholds of response. If we take a look specifically at the overall population or focus mainly on the population who remained R5 tropic, all patients achieved a 1 log or greater decline. Indeed, all but one who were R5 tropic had over a 1.5 log decline. And nearly half the population achieved a 2 log viral load decline at the nadir. You'll notice that the nadir, again, as you saw earlier, was at roughly day 17, with the range that's shown in the details here. About 40% of the patients actually achieved below 400 copies, but very few, of course, achieved less than 50 on this monotherapy study. In terms of the safety of the drug, there were no serious adverse events noted and no discontinuations for any reason. If we take a look at the adverse events that were reported, they were all of mild severity. There were 4 people who had at least one adverse event. Those adverse events are listed here. They were GI or other in origin. One person had 3 adverse events. The others were had by one patient only. Additional safety results. There's been a focus on the QTc issue based on data from either some animal work as well as other CCR5 inhibitors, and so that was done here. In terms of looking at the QTc prolongation, there are 2 ways that this is measured. One is to take a look at the mean change from baseline with a prolongation from baseline considered a worrisome finding. But here in this case, there was in fact a shortening. No prolongation was observed in the mean change for those on drug, and in fact very similar to placebo. The other way that this is analyzed is to take a look at the percent of subjects who have a prolongation by over 60 milliseconds, and no patient had that on placebo or 9471. Using a more conservative approach of looking at 30 milliseconds, a range that is of uncertain clinical significance, you'll see that that was 1 patient on placebo and 3 on 9471. In terms of transaminases, you can see that there were very few people who had grade 1 increases, and these were typically transient and resolved either during dosing or after. No patient had grade 2 or greater, and there were no other changes observed with chemistry or hematology parameters that were measured for the time period of the study. So finally, in conclusion, 200 milligrams of 9471 for 14 days was well tolerated. We observed no clinically significant chemistry, hematology, EKG events. None of these were observed. There was a rapid virologic response with a mean maximal viral load decline of 1.8 log observed at day 16. 16 of the 19 participants had a viral load decline of at least 1.5 log, and 16 of the 17 who remained R5 tropic had a 1.5 log or greater decline. You'll, of course, note that the viral load did stay suppressed beyond the dosing interval, an effect that's consistent with the prolonged plasma half-life. And again, I'll remind you that at day 28, 2 weeks past the last dose, the viral load was still 0.8 log below baseline. 2 patients had an unmasking of an X4-using virus population. And as I mentioned on preliminary analysis, these X4 populations appear to be arising from pre-existing variants. And therefore, we've concluded that 200 milligrams once daily warrants longer-term phase 2b studies in R5 screen populations. The safety and activity of other once-daily doses of 9471 are currently under investigation, and phase 2b studies are planned for 1 or more of these doses. So I'd like to acknowledge my co-investigators who participated and the patients at these sites, the folks at Monogram for their work on the trophile assay, the group at Insight who've been helping us develop this compound, and, of course, I3 Research. Thank you for your attention.
Questions? So, Carl, is this drug a CYP3A4 substrate or inducer?
Yeah, thanks very much. So this drug is neither an inducer nor an inhibitor of 3A4. The drug, however, is a substrate for the 3A4 system, and so work is now going on with other doses in the presence of ritonavir to explore how we'll have to alter the dose in the presence of ritonavir, and that work is now ongoing in the next phase 1 studies.
Ken, you mentioned that the patient has a tropism test at screening and baseline, and despite 2 tests which exhibit L5, some were not detected as dual mix. What is your comment? I mean, it's not specifically to this drug, but what is your comment about that? How often will we have to follow with these tropism tests, and what can be the confidence we have in the test?
Thank you very much for that question. That's very kind. I appreciate that. Can I have my next slide, please? I guess
I like the difficult question.
Yeah, thank you. I know I count on you. So I guess what I would say, Christine, is the field is trying to, I think, grapple with exactly the point you raise, and perhaps an improvement in the sensitivity of the assay or other assays will be necessary for us to increase the confidence that we know the patient populations that we're treating. But I think analogous to the issues of resistance, in which minority variants do show up as potentially relevant, even in conventional resistance assays, I think we have this challenge in all of our drug classes. I don't think the challenge is limited to R5, though I appreciate that that is a problem being observed in this class, but non-nucleoside resistance seems to emerge even when conventional assays say there is a wild-type virus. So I think that this is a challenge for our field in a broader way.
So microphone 4.
Hello. Owen Coakley from Monogram Biosciences. Cal, I want to relieve you a little bit of the duty there.
Thank you.
In the experienced population from the data that we have where there's repeated testing done, the switch rate between screen and baseline is between 8 and 10%. And that's based on the available data. And that looks like that represents, on cloning, actual biological circulating virus in the region of a few percent, 2 to 3%. And I think there's a growing sense that that actually is clinically relevant to this class. In naive individuals, when we look at screen to baseline, it's actually about 3%. So it's much less frequent, representing, I think, the actual underlying biology. And with regard to your comment on sensitivity, actually, we have a very active program looking at enhancing sensitivity down to levels around 1% or less.
Excellent. Thank you.
Can this drug be given less frequently than once a day?
Well, certainly the plasma half-life would suggest that it could, and indeed in the presence of ritonavir, which appears to prolong the half-life, that's one of the questions that we might be exploring in the future. Thank you very much.
No more questions.
So with that, I would like to thank all the speakers for the excellent presentations, and now the session is closed. Thank you.